This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Al-Qaeda and other jihadi groups have found a home in the border area between Pakistan and Afghanistan. And that's one of the things we're going to talk about with Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid. He's been covering extremist Islamic groups for years. We're also going to talk about Pakistan's connections to the alleged plot to blow up transatlantic planes, the resurgence of the Taliban in Afghanistan, and how the wars in Lebanon and Iraq are affecting jihadi groups. Rashid is the author of the book Taliban, which was published in 2000 and became a bestseller after September 11th. His 2002 book, Jihad, is about the rise of militant Islam in Central Asia. Rashid writes for English publications like the International Herald Tribune and the Daily Telegraph of London. Ahmed Rashid, welcome back to Fresh Air. What are some of the connections between Pakistan and the suspects in the alleged plot to bomb transatlantic flights from London to the United States?
Many of the suspects now under arrest and being charged by the British government are British citizens born in Britain, but they are of Pakistani origin. And they have been traveling back and forth between Britain and Pakistan. And it is in Pakistan that they probably got in touch with either Al-Qaeda or extremist groups who have trained them and have mobilized them in a sense. And of course, this was also the same issue arose last year when the bombings took place in the London Underground, where Pakistani-born suicide bombers detonated bombs and killed over 50 people.
Is Pakistan now the place to get jihadi training or financial assistance for jihadi plots?
Well, unfortunately, it is. I mean, primarily because, you know, the Al-Qaeda leadership is, I think, very much present in Pakistan. We've got now the even American authorities and British authorities saying that Osama bin Laden and his number two, Ayman al-Zawahiri, are no longer what they used to say on the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. Now they're saying more categorically that they're in Pakistan. Now, this means that if you're a potential jihadi and you want to go and detonate a bomb somewhere and you want to get the blessing of Osama bin Laden or even money or training from Al-Qaeda, you come to Pakistan and make contact with Al-Qaeda through Pakistan's own large number of extremist groups, groups who've been fighting in Kashmir, who've been fighting with the Taliban, and who have been giving logistical support and sanctuary to Al-Qaeda. So there is a huge network. I mean, in Pakistan right now, we've got Central Asian groups, Chechen groups, Indonesian groups, the Arabs, of course, plus Pakistanis, Kashmiris, Afghan Taliban, people from the Muslim areas of China.
Now, Pakistan's President Musharraf gave Britain information that was crucial in disrupting this alleged plot. And after 2001, he promised to crack down on extremist Islamic groups in Pakistan. So how has he been doing in delivering on that promise? Obviously, Pakistan was helpful in breaking this plot. On the other hand, Pakistan helped the plot before that. Not President Musharraf, but extremist groups in Pakistan did help the plotters.
Well, I think there are two issues at stake here. The first is that certainly Pakistan has been cooperating with Western intelligence agencies on individual cases. We saw that last year with the London Underground bombings. We've seen it again this year. And certainly there is, you know, very good cooperation on this case-by-case issue. Now, the problem is that the promises that Musharraf made to sort of clean up Pakistan, as it were, to rein in the madrasas, the religious schools, to disband and disarm some of these extremist groups in Pakistan, none of that has really taken place. And 5 years have gone by, and many Pakistanis are very frustrated. And certainly, I think, you know, Western governments are very frustrated. Musharraf does have an alliance with some of the Islamic parties, the mainstream Islamic parties. And the danger is that that alliance looks like being repeated. When we have elections in 2007, he will need allies in order to remain as president. He may go back to allying himself with these Islamic parties. And clearly, if he does so, that means his hands will be tied. He won't be able to carry out any kind of reform agenda. And so the real problem is that on a case-by-case basis, there is cooperation. But on actually improving the situation in Pakistan, very little has been done.
Let me mention another problem that you've written about, and I'll quote you here. You wrote, Pakistan is helpful on some cases. Then Western intelligence agencies are seduced by the assistance and are reluctant to urge Musharraf to carry out wider reforms that would slow down the spread of extremism in Pakistan. What kind of reforms might Musharraf introduce that could slow down extremism?
Well, there was a huge commitment made by Musharraf and by the Bush administration that they would support Musharraf in improving the literacy levels and educational system in Pakistan and promoting the state educational system, which is obviously a secular system, and also bring the madrasas under control. That is, have them registered, improve their curricula, eliminate any kind of reference to, you know, militancy or abuse to other religions like Christianity. Christianity and Judaism, etc. Now, none of this has really been carried out. The second major issue was to disarm and demobilize and perhaps retrain and re-educate thousands of militants who had been fighting with the Taliban, who had been fighting in Kashmir. Very little of this has happened too. In fact, what we're seeing in some areas of Pakistan has been a much worse situation than existed before 9/11. These extremist groups have been able to encourage people like the London bombers to come to Pakistan, train them in explosives or give them other kinds of training and then send them back. Now, clearly, that means, you know, terrorist camps are still in existence.
Musharraf is facing elections next year. You write that his popularity has hit an all-time low. Do you think it's in the West's best interest for him to remain in power?
Well, I really do think that there has to be a transition towards some kind of democratic rule. I think we need free and fair elections. Clearly, you know, given the very tense situation and the power of the military, I'm certainly not advocating a situation where the military should just totally abandon the fight against terrorism and just step back and sort of hand over to the civilians. I don't think that's possible. But the military has to accept that there has to be a genuine and a gradual transition to democratic rule. And certainly if you do get a properly elected government in 2007, there should be a partnership perhaps between the military and the government for a certain period of time in which both, you know, agree to take certain steps to carry out these long promised reforms. But the military has to accept that it has to take a back seat towards a gradual democratization. And unfortunately, the Americans are not backing it. After many promises made by the Americans, we saw after President Bush's re-election, this commitment to democracy in the Muslim world and the Arab world, there has been a lot of backtracking on that. We've seen that in Egypt, in other parts of the Arab world, and certainly we've seen that in Pakistan, where you had Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice making very strong statements in support of democracy about a year ago. And now there's nothing like that kind of support anymore.
Do you think that it's a bit of a hypocritical policy that it's we support democracy unless an authoritarian regime is our ally, in which case it's all right?
Exactly. I mean, I think, you know, I think many people and people in the Muslim world see this advocacy of democracy by President Bush at the beginning of his second term and then his backtracking on it as being incredibly hypocritical. We've just had the war in Lebanon where, you know, for the first time in as long as I can remember, the U.S. was not trying to broker a ceasefire. It was, in fact, encouraging Israel to carry on the war as long as possible so that Hezbollah could be wiped out. Now, here you have a situation where people's trust in the U.S. as being, if you like, an honest broker in the Middle East, the U.S. promoting democracy, I think people's trust has been really shattered. And there is now an enormous amount of anti-Americanism sweeping through the Muslim world.
My guest is Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid, the author of Taliban and Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Ahmed Rashid. He's a journalist based in Pakistan who writes for the International Herald Tribune and the Daily Telegraph. He's the author of the bestseller Taliban and of the book Jihad, which is about Islamist groups in Central Asia. You write that Pakistan is now awash with far more dangerous forms of Islamic extremism than ever existed before 9/11. What makes these groups more dangerous and more extreme?
Well, I think the fact that they've lasted out 5 years of promises of reform and repression by Musharraf, that they have become far more sophisticated in staying underground, in not being caught, in being able to train people from around the world still and send them back to their home countries. They have been trying very hard to establish a kind of base area in this tribal region between Afghanistan and Pakistan, and in at least one area, the tribal agencies of North and South Waziristan, they have succeeded in establishing a base area where literally there's a truce with the Pakistan Army, and the Pakistan Army does not interfere in what these people do. And on the other frontier, of course, there was a lot of hope that the peace process with India would bear fruit. And the major fruit for Pakistan would be its ability to disarm thousands of militants who had been fighting in Kashmir. Now, unfortunately, after 3 years of this peace process, we haven't seen much progress. The Pakistanis blame the Indians blame the Pakistanis. But certainly one result has been that Pakistan has not been willing or able to disarm the militants who have been fighting in Kashmir.
So is there part of the border area of Pakistan and Afghanistan that is basically an independent Islamist state practicing Islamic law outside of Pakistan's jurisdiction?
Well, in the tribal agencies of North and South Waziristan, this is a kind of no man's land that existed between the two countries. And this is the area where initially bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda leadership escaped to after escaping from Afghanistan in 2001. It is here that the Pashtun tribesmen, who have been very close to the Taliban, have now become very close to Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda spent a lot of money in wooing these Pashtun tribals. Tribesmen here. It is here the after a lot of American pressure, the Pakistan Army went in to Waziristan in 2003 to try and wipe out these pockets of extremists and their camps. The extremists fought back. Something like 600 Pakistani soldiers have been killed in this region. And now, in a sense, there's a very tenuous truce in which the both the army pledges not to attack the extremists, and the extremists say, we will not attack the Pakistan army. But of course, what these extremists have been doing in the past and will continue to do is to cross the border into Afghanistan and attack Afghan army and American army units who are based just across the border. And I think, you know, this is a very tenuous truce, but it shows the weakness, really, of the state of Pakistan as being unable to wipe out these militants. Having suffered such grievous losses, 600 troops dead, they've had little choice but to strike some kind of truce, which frankly, according to most people, is not going to hold very long.
But this also means that there's a kind of safe haven for jihadi groups to practice and to do whatever it is they're doing.
Well, exactly. I mean, they're called the Pakistani Taliban. They're allied to Al-Qaeda. They have imposed a completely Talibanized political and social structure as what existed in Afghanistan before 9/11. For example, TVs are banned. Women can't appear. There's no education for women. And they've imposed this structure in this area. They have completely thrown out any semblance of the Pakistan state, that is the local administration, the local educational system, etc. And at the same time, they're still being able to bring in and out militants from around the world and from Pakistan, give people training, indoctrinate them, send them back to where they came from. And clearly it is from here that Al-Qaeda is also being able to make these videotapes that we're seeing. Now, clearly there's a very sophisticated media setup now that they've got, that where these tapes are made, where they're distributed, where they're sent out to the TV channels around the world. Now, all this is happening from this part of the world.
Have you been to this area?
Well, this area now is completely off limits. You can only go in with the military, and they have these guided tours. They take people around. You can't see very much, obviously, in these guided tours, but the press is banned. So really, there's very little information coming out as to, apart from the handouts that the military gives or the handouts that the Taliban gives, there's very little independent confirmation. And you see, people, the other problem is that a lot of tribesmen have opposed this Pakistani Taliban movement, and a lot of them have been killed, or the majority have been driven out. So we've had a kind of ethnic cleansing where any opposition to this Talibanization program, people opposing it have been literally been driven out. They are now refugees in other parts of Pakistan. And this is something that hasn't been highlighted. But what it means is simply that out in North and South Waziristan, the Taliban will not tolerate anyone who does not support them.
So in this jihadi area, are there a number of different jihadi groups working together?
Yes, certainly. For example, I mean, we know the groups that are operating there are the Afghan Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and several other Afghan groups opposed to the Americans and President Karzai, the group Hizb-e Islami, which is led by a former guerrilla commander, Gulbuddin Hikmatyar, another group led by Jalaluddin Haqqani. There is the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, which is the main Central Asian group fighting the regimes in Central Asia. There are several Chechen groups represented there. There are representatives of Uyghur militant groups. That is, the Uyghurs are the Muslim Chinese from Xinjiang province in western China. And of course, there are numerous Pakistani groups and Kashmiri groups.
And they're working in concert with each other, maybe in ways that they haven't before. I mean, are they more unified than they've ever been?
I think they're very unified. I mean, they have their own objectives, as it were. You know, the Chechens or the Central Asians would be concentrating on the former Soviet Union. But I think where they're unified is to be able to build up a base area, to be able to operate freely, to be able to bring in their militants. We've also got reports, for example, that large numbers of Arabs now, several hundred Arabs are coming back from the fighting in Iraq. They're joining up with the Afghan Taliban and with other militant groups in Waziristan to fight in Afghanistan. And that now there is certainly this traffic between Iraq and the Afghan Taliban. And many of the tactics we're seeing now in the war in southern Afghanistan are in fact tactics that the Taliban have learned from Iraq.
What do you think the options are for dealing with this no man's land in the border area of Afghanistan and Pakistan, where so many Islamic groups have taken refuge?
Well, tell you, I mean, it may be, you know, too late now in a sense, but I mean, initially after 9/11, the fact is that this no man's land, really, there was a very, I went there several times in 2002, 2003, and there was this very intense debate at that time amongst the tribesmen as to what kind of status they wanted. They had been living for the last 150 years under a British demarcated areas and laws, and what they wanted was a more modern political system, and they wanted a referendum, if you like, should have been held there, where they could decide whether they wanted to be part of the Northwest Frontier province of Pakistan, or they wanted to form a separate province of Pakistan. Basically, they needed a chance to be able to determine their own political destiny. And that chance was not given them because, you know, we had a military regime in Pakistan which did not have a free and fair election and was certainly not going to allow the tribal areas to have a referendum to decide what they wanted. Now, unfortunately, that it was a golden opportunity. What was needed was a political decision by the people of that area to decide what status they wanted to live under. Now, if that had happened, I don't think the extremists and the fundamentalists would have been able to take over this region in the way they have. The fact that now there's no political argument, now the only argument is jihad and we want a Sharia state, that is, we want a state governed by Islamic law. There's no other debate on, you know, should we be part of this province or that province or have an independent province or democracy or anything like that.
So, just one more thing about this no man's land. Do you envision in the future there will be an attack by the West on this land to try to drive out or stop the Islamist groups? Do you think Pakistan will do something? Or do you think it's just going to go on the way it is?
Well, the reason why I think this truce that is there between the militants and the Pakistan army is so tenuous is that it can be broken at any time, either by the militants or by the Americans. What happens if the militants, cross over and kill large numbers of Americans on the other side? The Americans are going to respond. What happens if the Americans discover through satellite surveillance or other means that Osama bin Laden has suddenly arrived for a meeting there? They're going to bomb the militant stronghold. And that, of course, is going to break the truce. So certainly I don't think this is a long-term option. And eventually Pakistan, with the help of the West, is going to have to sort out this region. And it will have to be done militarily, unfortunately, now.
Ahmed Rashid is a journalist based in Lahore, Pakistan. His books include Taliban and Jihad. He writes for the International Herald Tribune and the Daily Telegraph of London. We'll talk more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Ahmed Rashid, a Pakistani journalist based in Lahore. He's written extensively about jihadi groups. His books include the bestseller Taliban and Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. He writes for the International Herald Tribune and the Daily Telegraph of London. We've been talking about that no man's land in the border area of Pakistan and Afghanistan, in which Islamic extremist groups are living. Meanwhile, in Afghanistan, how much power has the Taliban regained?
Well, the second major area in Pakistan that is really very unsafe is further south in the province of Balochistan, around the town of Quetta, which borders southern Afghanistan. And it is here that you have the remains of the Taliban. Now, here there are no foreigners, there are no Arabs, there's no Al-Qaeda. This is a pure Afghan Taliban movement. It is to this area where tens of thousands of Taliban retreated in 2001. Many of them set up, lived in refugee camps. Others who were wealthy bought property. They set up madrasas, religious schools. And it's from here that the old Taliban leadership has been recruiting a new generation of fighters. And what we've seen now in the last 3 or 4 months in southern Afghanistan is that the Taliban have moved back into southern Afghanistan in a very big way, with a lot of new weapons, a lot of logistical support coming from the Pakistan side of the border. And the reason is that the American troops in the south, who were very small in number and very limited, were replaced by NATO troops in the spring, Canadians, British, Dutch, Australians. And there has been a much more determined effort by NATO to get control of the south from the Taliban, to begin reconstruction and to try and eliminate the drugs trade. Most of the poppy, which is turned into heroin, is grown in these southern provinces in Afghanistan. Now, that replacement of the Americans by NATO troops has encouraged the Taliban to launch this massive offensive. And what they are depending on is that many of these countries who are giving troops to this deployment, there's a lot of opposition at home.
Why did the United States withdraw troops from Afghanistan?
Well, I think when this decision was made about 2 years ago, the U.S. was looking at the upcoming congressional elections, which is going to take place in November this year, and perhaps looking even to the next elections in the U.S. I think Secretary Rumsfeld wanted to bring home American troops from somewhere. Clearly, it was not going to happen in Iraq, given that the insurgency was going full blast in Iraq. And I think that there was a very strong need and desire, both militarily and politically, to try and bring some troops back home. That's just sent a very negative signal. It sent a very negative signal to the Afghan government and to President Karzai, who has berated the Americans ever since for even announcing such a thing. Because, of course, what it shows Afghans is that perhaps the Americans are losing confidence in Karzai. And, of course, it sent a very strong signal to the Taliban saying, oh, we always knew the Americans would run. They would never stay in Afghanistan. They couldn't hack it. They haven't done reconstruction, and now they're just going to leave. And that certainly encouraged this Taliban offensive.
What condition is the Karzai government in now?
Well, I think, you know, that's the other part of the conundrum. I mean, one side, you do have a Taliban insurgency, which is partly being fueled by their bases in Pakistan, the fact that they have support from all these other groups, Al-Qaeda, etc., and the fact that there was very little military presence in southern Afghanistan for the last 5 years. Now, the other part of this has been the failure of the government, quite simply. Yes, the international community has not delivered money and resources to reconstruct the country the way the Afghans wanted and the way it should have been done. But given what resources were given to the Afghan government, unfortunately, they've not been used very well. There is massive corruption. The drugs trade has exacerbated. Karzai has been striking tactical deals with warlords, with corrupt officials and the police and the army, and with the tribal leaders in order to gain time for this or that tactical advantage without really looking at the big picture and seeing how grievously these tactical alliances of his are harming the big picture and really aggravating the Afghan public. Because what they're seeing is that the old, corrupt, discredited people from the past are still ruling over them.
One of the things that helped the Taliban come to power after the Soviets withdrew from Afghanistan was that they were seen by the people as an alternative to the anarchy in Afghanistan and to the corrupt and brutal local rule of the warlords. Is that kind of thing in danger of happening again? Like, if the Karzai government continues to lose popularity, might the Taliban be seen as some kind of viable alternative?
Well, I 6 months ago, I would have said that even in southern Afghanistan, the majority of Afghans, and by majority, I mean 80 or 90% of the Afghans, would not support the return of the Taliban, which is why the Taliban, for the last 2 or 3 years, had remained a guerrilla movement without much mass support. But I think the situation has changed very drastically in the last 6 to 9 months. There is much greater public support in the south. But we have to also understand that this insurgency of the Taliban is within the ethnic boundaries of the Taliban. The Taliban are drawn from the Pashtun tribes, which is the largest ethnic group in Afghanistan, but certainly it does not have any sway in the west or the north. And the Taliban insurgency remains confined to the south. Now, clearly, they are trying to send groups up into the north. There's been attacks on NATO troops in western Afghanistan, close to the border with Iran. But these are not their traditional bases. So it's not that the Taliban aim really or possibility is that they could topple Karzai. What I think they're trying to do is to literally cut off the south from the rest of the country and try and take territory, hold it, and be able to set up a new kind of Sharia state. In other words, a repetition of what they were doing before 9/11.
But just in a smaller level.
In a smaller area. And clearly, you know, one of their messages to the Pashtun population and to other Afghans is that we will bring law and order. The Karzai is corrupt. His regime is corrupt. There's no law and order. These foreign forces are killing civilians, are bombing the wrong targets. There is, drugs trafficking, etc. Now, and that's the kind of message that the Taliban had before 9/11, and it's the kind of message they're still giving.
So if the Taliban succeed in setting up an independent area in the south of Afghanistan, what would the consequences be?
Oh, I think the consequences would be catastrophic for Afghanistan. Clearly, the Karzai government, the ripple effect of that would really not allow Karzai to stay in power very long. I think there would be a demand from other ethnic groups, the Tajiks, the Uzbeks, for a much tougher line. And God forbid, I mean, there could be talk of the division of Afghanistan, which would be really catastrophic. Because, you know, Afghanistan is has stuck together for the last 300-400 years, but it is a patchwork of ethnic groups. And many of these ethnic groups have their counterparts in neighboring countries. Just like the Pashtuns are in both Afghanistan and Pakistan, the Uzbeks are in Central Asia as well as in Afghanistan. So any move like that would be very dangerous. But I think clearly it would make the whole war on terrorism a defeat as far as the Americans are concerned, because the war on terrorism, despite the Bush administration's desire to try and link it with Iraq and link it with Hezbollah and Lebanon, the war on terrorism remains a very specific thing. And we should remember that it is a war, it's a struggle against Islamic extremism as expressed by Al-Qaeda and its allies and the affiliate groups. And these affiliate groups are very largely still based in the Afghanistan-Pakistan region. And if they were given or allowed to operate from a large base area, clearly, I think, you know, the world would be in very serious danger.
My guest is Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid, the author of Taliban and Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Ahmed Rashid, and he's a journalist based in Pakistan who covers Pakistan, Afghanistan, and also writes about Islamic extremist groups in Central Asia. He writes for the International Herald Tribune and the Daily Telegraph. He's the author of the bestseller Taliban and of a book called Jihad about Islamist groups in Central Asia. We've been talking primarily about the Islamic extremist groups based in that border area between Afghanistan and Pakistan. What impact do you think the war in Lebanon has had on the jihadi groups?
Well, unfortunately, I think the war in Lebanon has been an enormously contributing factor to mobilization and many people believing that Islamist forces are the only way to resist Israel and the United States. There have been two very serious repercussions, I think. The first is that the traditional way of the United States since the Second World War to try and prevent war in the Middle East and to try and bring about quick ceasefires so that the wars do not expand was abandoned by the Bush administration in the war in Lebanon. And we saw the American administration, in fact, allowing the Israelis to continue the war for something like 33 days before a ceasefire took place. Now, this has had an enormous impact in the wider Muslim world, I think, where any kind of idea that the Americans would be an honest broker between Israel and the Arab states or would try and broker a settlement over Israel and the Palestinian issue, I think that hope has really gone. I don't foresee even America's allies, for example, the Saudi kings or King Abdullah of Jordan or even the Egyptian president, anytime soon asking the United States now to mediate in the conflict between Israel and Palestine. I think any Arab ruler who now goes to Washington and asks for American mediation would be shouted down by his own people. And that is really unfortunate. I think the second major impact of Lebanon, of course, has been the role of Hezbollah. Now, Hezbollah, I think, is very disliked by many people in Lebanon, by Sunnis, by the Christians, by the Druze, because many people inside Lebanon see Hezbollah's actions as causing the total destruction of Lebanon, the bombing of Lebanon by the Israelis, the destruction of the infrastructure, etc. But outside Lebanon, in the broader Muslim world, there's no doubt that Hezbollah is a hero. This is a guerrilla force of a couple of thousand people who has been coming out in the Islamic press, has stood up to Israel for 33 days, has been able to inflict considerable damage on Israel, has not been eliminated despite all the efforts of the traditionally victorious Israeli army. And so outside Lebanon, the idea is that, you know, not only is Hezbollah a hero, but the projection is that only Hezbollah being an Islamist force, although it is a Shia Islamist force, even in the Sunni world, the fact that an Islamic force has stood up to Israel means that Islam everywhere, Islamist forces everywhere, have been boosted. The PLO was not able to stand up to Israel. The PLO, the Palestinian Al-Fatah organization, which is a secular organization, a democratically elected secular organization, has not been able to stand up to Israel. So I think, you know, the double message here is extremely dangerous for the future of stability in the Muslim world.
Part of the popularity of Hezbollah has to do with the fact that in addition to being an armed group, it also does a lot of social work. It sets up charities and hospitals. And now it's taking a leading role in helping people whose homes were bombed by Israel. Is this the wave of the future with Islamist groups? Do you think that they have two faces, the military face, but they also have that good Samaritan face and do genuinely helpful work?
Yes, I mean, I think it is. I mean, we saw even Al-Qaeda. I mean, for example, Bin Laden used to personally write checks out to the wives and children of those militants who died in Al-Qaeda operations. So certainly, you know, there's a long-standing attempt by these groups to have a social side to them. But of course, with Hezbollah, it's been very dependent on the fact that they have had state support from Iran, which is loaded with petrodollars at the moment, given the high price of oil, and has been and can afford to send large sums of money to Hezbollah and by Syria. Now, you know, other such militant groups don't have state support. Al-Qaeda clearly doesn't have state support. It's been dependent on donations from wealthy sympathizers, around the world, but particularly from Saudi Arabia. Many of those donations may be drying up now. So I think that kind of face would all these militant groups would like to have the faith. For example, in the recent earthquake in Pakistan last year, we saw these Kashmiri militant groups making a big comeback by becoming relief groups, by digging people out of the rubble, setting up camps, providing medical aid, etc. So certainly that is something that is going to be a growing part of, I think, the Islamic movement.
In terms of Iraq right now, there's debate in the United States about what the next step for the United States should be. Should we be withdrawing troops and handing things over more and more to Iraqi security and to the Iraqi government? Or should we make sure we stay until things are much more safe and secure and to prevent any kind of civil war from worsening? Do you have a sense of that?
Well, I think clearly the U.S. cannot pull out. It cannot give a date certain and just pull out. There would be horrendous repercussions. On the other hand, what the Americans really need to do is to start a dialogue with all the neighbors, including Iran and Syria, about the future of Iraq. The big danger is if once the Americans pull out and if this government falls in Baghdad, the neighbors are all going to come in and promote a kind of civil war of the kind that we saw in Afghanistan in the 1990s. And what is needed is a deal to be hammered out that the neighboring interference would be reduced to a minimum. Now, you know, perhaps it's too late for that. This is something that the Americans should have done a long time ago, certainly 2 years ago. And of course, what it means is that you have to talk to Iran, because Iran is the state which has interfered the most, which is backing some of the Shia militant groups in Iraq. And without a dialogue between the Americans and the Iranians on the future of Iraq, there is no way that the Americans can guarantee stability in Iraq.
Well, you mentioned that you think the Americans should be negotiating with Iran and Syria about the future of Iraq. That does not seem like it's about to happen anytime in the near future.
Well, unfortunately, if it doesn't happen, I mean, we are going to see this continuing slide into civil war. I mean, we've already had a lot of ethnic cleansing going on in some of the major cities in Baghdad, the separation of Sunni and Shia populations, the arming of militias, and there's very little, it seems, that the Iraqi government or the American forces are able to do about the sectarian divide and about the militant resistance that is coming, to the government. What I still feel is the biggest danger, and an even bigger danger, would be direct foreign interference. by the neighboring states, with the Sunnis being backed up by perhaps Jordan and Saudi Arabia, and the Shias being certainly backed up by Iran, and it's already happening at a clandestine, covert level, probably, and certainly the Iranians are doing it. The danger is if this happens overtly, publicly, in a very overt way, then we would really be talking about the breakup of Iraq.
My guest is Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid. He's the author of Taliban and Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Ahmed Rashid. He's a journalist based in Pakistan who covers particularly Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia. He writes for the International Herald Tribune and the Daily Telegraph. He's the author of the bestseller Taliban and of the book Jihad about Islamist terrorist groups in Central Asia. Let me divert your attention to Iran for a moment. Iran says it's willing to resume talks, but it didn't indicate whether it would agree to stop enriching and reprocessing uranium. The United States says this falls short of UN demands. And meanwhile, a new report from a House Intelligence Committee led by Republican Peter Hoekstra portrayed Iran as a growing threat and criticized American spy agencies for cautious assessments of Iran's weapons programs. Give me like your sense of what's happening with Iran right now.
Well, I think certainly you do have a government in Tehran which is trying to revive the spirit and the politics of the 1979 Iranian Revolution, which had certainly died down in the last 8 to 10 years. And under the former president, President Khatami, who was a moderate and who had tried to start a dialogue with the United States, there were much more political and social freedoms. And clearly the new regime is trying to roll all that back, and one of the ways it is being able to roll it back is to have a confrontation with the US, which is very reminiscent of what happened in 1979, if we remember those 3 or 4 very difficult years, the hostage crisis, etc. But the difference is, of course, that the US, as far as what people see in the Muslim world, the US is much weaker now. The US is bogged down in Iraq, and certainly in Iraq, the empowerment of the Shias. You have a Shia-dominated government, and within that government you have people who are very close to Iran, and really a civil war, if it erupts, is going to force the Americans to abandon Iraq, and the Iranians see that all to their advantage. In Lebanon, you have a Shia group which has stood up to Israel. The Hezbollah are seen as the heroes in Iran, as in the wider Muslim world, and in a sense, Hezbollah have revived this idea that Shia Islamic militancy, which had for a few years been overshadowed by Al-Qaeda and Sunni Islamic militancy, now Iran is seeing that Shia Islamic militancy is once again on the rise, and if you like, is in a kind of competition with Al-Qaeda and Sunni militancy. So Iran certainly sees itself on a roll.
Ahmed Rashid, I don't know if you've heard this story or not, but Henry Rollins, the former punk rocker and performance artist, was traveling by plane in Australia. And on the plane, he was reading your book, Jihad, about the rise of militant Islam in Central Asia. Apparently, he says, the passenger next to him noticed that he was reading the book, Jihad, reported him to the authorities, and later Rollins was called by a member of the Australian government, asking what was going on, and he explained that he was reading your book, and the whole thing was dropped. So I'm wondering, like, if you heard that story, and if you hear that kind of thing happening a lot, that somebody's like reading one of your books, and because the word jihad or Taliban is in the title, they're seen as being suspicious.
No, I must say I haven't heard that story. It's quite a wonderful story. But just a few months ago, there was a story in the New York Times about the American 10th Mountain Division, who were preparing for deployment in Afghanistan, and every single soldier had been given a copy of my book Taliban, and it was put on the top of their rucksack. And the New York Times was describing how in Fort Drum near New York, the soldiers were sort of loading up their rucksacks, and everybody had the book right on the front, and they were all being told to read it. And of course, you know, I mean, it was gratifying in one sense. But of course, I said, well, if the jihadists read this also, they're certainly going to see, you know, that this book is helping the Americans, and they're not going to like this very much. So there is, you know, a plus side and a minus side.
So, in other words, you were concerned about your safety with the American troops having your book strapped to their rucksacks?
Well, sure. I mean, with, you know, that kind of publicity, it was, you know, and especially with the New York Times sort of pointing it out in you know, writing two or three paragraphs about it, certainly one was concerned about one's safety and all.
But were there no consequences, I hope?
No, nothing more than usual.
More than usual? What do you mean by more than usual?
Well, I mean, certainly, you know, one, you know, I mean, there have been threats and things in the past, especially since 9/11.
Right.
As a result of my, you know, the Taliban book, for example, came out in all the local languages, in Urdu, in Pakistan, and in Pashto and Dari, which are the two main languages in Afghanistan. So, every, you know, all the Taliban have now read it in Pashto. and it's come out in Arabic as well, of course, which means that all of Al-Qaeda has read it, too.
Ooh, any feedback from them?
Well, you know, you keep getting, they've died down a lot, but certainly after 9/11, there were a lot of threats made in the post, on telephone, you know, I was for a period, you know, quite concerned about my family, etc.
Well, listen, thank you so much for talking with us. Be well, and thank you.
Thank you very much.
Ahmed Rashid is a journalist based in Lahore, Pakistan. His books include Taliban and Jihad. He writes for the International Herald Tribune and the Daily Telegraph of London.